Listening to all of that, old friend of Countrywide, a man who has just written a new book, Seamus O'Rourke, how are you?
Good morning, Philip.
Very familiar sounds to you there. That's just a couple of miles down the road.
That's just a couple of miles down the road. They're the greatest people on this earth, West Cavan. They're great part of the world.
Enough miles down the road for the rivalry to be really intense or far enough away that you could be friends with them?
Oh no, they're across the border. So club-wise, they're of no threat. Cavan as a county team would be a major threat, and so anytime we ever played Cavan, we put in the boot.
How are you feeling about compliments at the moment? If I start handing them out, are you going to hope that the ground will just sort of open up and swallow you up?
It's not something we're used to down our way, but yeah, go have a stab.
The new book, Leaning on Gates, is the funniest thing I have read in ages. And you had me doing something every second or third page that I don't, generally speaking, ever do when I read a book. I was laughing out loud. And then, at the same time, 2 pages later, I'd have a moment.
Mm.
Because, oh my God, you lay on the poignancy, something rotten.
Yeah.
And yet, you were reluctant to write this book.
Yeah, I was. I think it's an extension of the way I look at it now. It's an extension of my performance on stage, and that's the only way that I could get myself to write it with an audience in mind. I never thought of myself as an author, but I started to write plays because I wanted to perform, and I knew that unless I wrote them myself, I wasn't going to get a whole lot of work. So that's where the writing came in, and it was suggested many years ago that I might write a memoir, and I tried, and I got bored with my own story, and I left it there. And then I went back in 2020 with a new approach, which was to zoom in on tiny little details of my life and explore them, as opposed to
your youth, standing in gaps.
Yeah.
And so it was your reluctance in this one that you were dealing with, well, frankly, the awkward and the ugly years in any young man's life from 18 to mid-20s.
Yeah. Standing in Gaps was a nice book to write. It was very nostalgic and was talking about old times. This one, all of a sudden, and it wasn't until I started writing that I realised I'm going to have to deal with my bigger self. And it was quite painful at times. And I'm not saying that flippantly. It was because there's no point in writing it if you're not completely honest. So I had to do that, knowing that the whole country were going to realise what a neejit I was in my youth.
But anyway. I think the only man in the world who doesn't look back on that period of 18 to 25 and go, oh God, is probably running for election in America right now. You're very hard on yourself, but my God, are you funny. I mean, line after line after line. Me, full of the woes of being an overgrown 18-year-old, my youth had been one prolonged nappy rash. An uninflated spare tire of a fella like me. Yeah. You're very hard on yourself.
Well, I was encouraged. We were encouraged to use language like that. You know, we there was never too many compliments running around the house, and you know, I was told at a very young age that I had an ass's nose and all sorts of things. Never in any there was never any venom attached to it, but we use humour as a way of entertaining ourselves. But we also, it was also, we never made sure that we never lost the run of ourselves.
And the creative level of abuse coming from the sidelines of the pitch that you found yourselves on, my God, you'd want to be in fairly robust mental health to endure some of the stuff that was being thrown at you. Put your head where you wouldn't put your hand, young fella.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the supporters long ago, of course, were not allowed to abuse players or refs anymore with verbally. But that time there was a great turn of phrase on the sideline, and it did affect. I mean, I was I got lots of abuse, and it didn't sit well with me. I mean, it's not the nicest thing in the world to be doing your best and someone fleece you out of it. And my I have a production company called Big Gorilla Productions, and that name came out of some fella shouting in. I was after hitting some young lad, and he was stretched out, and this fella shouts, "Put that big gorilla back in his cage."
Now, your self-flagellation is at the centre of the book, but so too are your parents. Who was in the house at that time between 18 and 25 during the period of this book?
Well, there was four kids altogether. My eldest sister Margaret had left the nest at this stage. So there was myself and my brother Kevin, who's the farmer, and then my younger sister Geraldine, and then my mother and father. And we were farming a small farm, and we were also moving into a new house, and
with all kinds of exotic luxuries like flushing toilets.
I mean, it's a bit strange to think of that now. It's hard to explain this to my kids that, you know, I was 17 and we still hadn't a flushing toilet at that stage, you know. And
I want you to set up a reading that you have done for us about when your parents go to the charity dance in the local hall.
Yeah. My parents didn't go out very often. We always had them at the fireside. My mother would always be knitting or trying to do something useful, and my father might read the paper for a very short time, but they were always working or around the house. So they never went out. Never went to anything, but in this particular scene, they were at this charity dance in Carrigallen, and I happened to be at the same dance, and I have never been as embarrassed in all my life.
As we will hear now, this is Seamus reading from Leaning on Gates.
Saturday mornings were always different in our house, but this was the morning after Pat McKenna's social, and my parents were still soft in the cheeks from being out the night before. He had danced with my mother the night before, out of duty more than anything else. A surreal moment for me. I'm sure no one batted an eyelid, but I did. What were they thinking? The tallest of the tall in Carrigallen, dancing with a woman always claiming but never reaching 5'2". It was like he was wheeling a miniature statue of Our Lady around the floor. Surely they didn't have to do this in public. Mammy smiling the 1-2-3s while he went off with his head up, and from his belly button up it looked like he was dancing on his own. Of course it was only good manners to dance, seeing that it was a dance, but this wasn't my parents. My parents should know better than to do such an intimate thing in public. Their dance should have been limited to their everyday lives, from the jigs and reels of spring and summer to the slow waltzes of autumn and winter. In the kitchen, with their things in the yellow cabinet and the pull-down flap, the Rayburn range and the side tank, the high-up mirror where Daddy combed his hair and where Mammy couldn't see, the calendar with the cow's times and the Sacred Heart lamp on the wall. They could dance their dance in the scullery with the American washing machine and the coal press for the milk and the dinted buckets on the floor. They could dance by the green metal press over the sink with Daddy's shaving things, the veterinary supplies and the bags of blue, the penicillin, the teat dip and the caustic sticks for dehorning calves, or by the buckets of drinking water for the house, cornered by the Corleen Wellingtons and the cat's meow. My parents could dance their dance in the byre and by the hayshed, in the ripples of the cow tracks across the fields. They could dance in the bog and in the meadow, saving the hay and digging the spuds, offending no one as they did. That was their way. They were not suited to stepping out in front of everyone at a parish social, but charity and duty had pulled this reluctant pair to the fore, and to me, a mixed-up brat of a boy at the time, they seemed to suffocate and dull in the smoking light.
Seamus O'Rourke from Leaning on Gates. The title is just absolutely perfect as a follow-up to Standing in Gaps, But you're not going to claim any credit for it.
No. There were, I think there was about 10 different people suggested leaning on Gates after they had read Standing in Gaps. So I tried very hard to come up with my own title, but I couldn't get anything as fitting as that. So the people are always right.
One of the important things in any book, obviously, is that our hero goes on something of a journey, and you go on quite a journey here, from a young fella who would have spontaneously come busted if he was asked to talk to a member of the opposite sex at the beginning of the book, to a young fella who manages to stand up three girls on the same night. Yes. By the time we're coming towards the close of the book, how did that come about?
I genuinely don't know. I got caught in the mix of rural pubs and drinking, and then a little taste of Dublin and a little bit of America for a while, and I got that terrible disease at one stage called confidence. Which did me no good. Thankfully, it's gone now.
You must have been a sort of a pleasant and agreeable young lad who just couldn't say no to
exactly,
a lady. You
yeah.
just had to say yes and then disappoint them.
Yeah, keep say yes to everything because we were always afraid that if you said no, you'd never get the chance again. So we grew up agreeing to everything and saying yes, and I said yes on many occasion, but then didn't have the maturity to follow through. That was my problem.
Well, and the other problem that you confront in the book here as well, on that particular night, you chose pints over any one of those three girls.
Yeah. This was one of the things that the book starts out when I'm turning 18, and at the time I didn't drink or smoke or do anything like that, and I was a teetotaler until I was 20. So you would imagine that I would have been mature enough to be able to handle the alcohol, but it wasn't. There was some calling to the town in our time. We were, my father used to say, "What is in this bloody town?" But it wasn't the alcohol. It was it was getting to the pub and the fun and the crack. And that time, rural pubs were thriving. You wouldn't if you went to the pub any later than 8 o'clock on a Friday or Saturday night, you wouldn't get a seat.
The pints and the crack, but oh my God, the style. And this the 1980s. Can you open your prayer book there, please, for me on page 195?
Yes.
I want you to actually read for me, please, about the style of it.
Oh, yeah. On Christmas night, I went to the Sportsman in Mohill to the disco. And because it was Christmas night, the bar didn't open till midnight. Fair enough. I didn't need drink. I was glowing enough from my recent sporting achievements. Women kept looking over. It was amazing. I stood with my back to the bar, 7-up in hand, and everyone was looking over. Yes, the women, but the men too. They couldn't help but admire the fine specimen that I was. I had my 501 jeans, I had big American runners and a polo neck black shirt. And to go with that, I had a white shoulder padded jacket with the buttons going diagonally across my chest. A bit of a George Michael look. I was loving the attention. I was weighing up my options. Stay where I was and avoid disappointment, which was never a bad option, or go for one of these chicks. There were no standout beauties, but they were all looking over. I turned around to the bar to gain more composure, and as I straightened myself, I could see this big wall clock above my head. That's what they were looking at, not me. Not my physique, not my mesmerizing fashion sense. They were watching the clock creep towards midnight. They were waiting for the bar to open.
Ah, dear, waiting for the bar to open. What I love about this Odyssey as well is that it takes, anybody of a certain age, over the age of 50, it'll take them back to places that they all were, particularly the bed sits of North Circular Road and places like that.
Yeah.
You can almost feel the fungus growing on you as soon as you walk in and open that chapter.
I went to Dublin, I think it was 1986, and it was so easy to get a bed sit at the time, 20 quid. It was a room with a bed in the corner and an electric cooker and a toilet somewhere else in the house. And I was only there a week, and there was three of us, three lads sharing this very small room. And yeah, the fungus had much better time than we had. I'll tell you that anyway.
I want to get one last clip in that you recorded for us, because the book Leaning on Gates finishes Leaning on Gates with your dad, and it's powerful stuff.
Some sons regret aspects of their relationship with their fathers. I don't. Some regret that they never hugged their fathers. I don't. Coming at my father with a hug would be like coming at him with a sledge. It would crush him and me. I loved my father, and I loved not loving him. And we had our moments of pure togetherness without the gloss of rubs and hugs and I love yous. And I also loved that sometimes he was my nemesis, my roadblock, my point of anger. Because when I was angry, it was always at myself. But he offered himself as a sacrificial lamb to be slaughtered by his own son for crimes uncommitted. Because if he was going to be hated, he wanted it to be by me. And in love and hate and all the gooseberries in between, we racked up a ton of strength and compromise. When he eventually heard one of my first recitations about a father-son relationship, subtly entitled, "What kind of an egot are you?" he passed it off saying, "Sure, only for me, he'd have nothing to write about. Rub it in, why don't you?" And the last thing he said to me 12 years later, as he was getting ready to die, he said, "You better go back and finish tiling that floor. No point leaving it half done." And I didn't hug him then either. And when I returned a few hours later, he was gone. My father and me were different. He was whole, and I was only half done. We had the same wiring, the same composition, and we both made things. But while I made things for show, he made things to last. My singing was loud, his was quiet and tuneful.
There is no man that will read that and not find a little bit of their own relationship with their dad in it. Fair play to you. The only outstanding question that I have for you is, when Netflix come to serialise this, who do you want to play you? Paul Mescal, my producer, is suggesting.
Oh, right, here. Okay. Yeah.
I think that Brendan Gleeson probably has a son somewhere who would be fitting.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Mescal probably is a much better footballer than I was in my prime, so maybe him.
You've three children, three grandchildren. Grandson's Fionn's 7th birthday.
Yes.
Today, isn't it? So we'll allow you to wish him happy birthday.
Yeah, so happy, big happy birthday to Fionn. Actually, it's next week, but okay. Yeah.
Leaning on Gates by Seamus O'Rourke, published by Gill. In bookshops now?
In bookshops now.
Excellent. And already the texts are coming in from the people who know that they're going to enjoy this one. Congratulations. Well done.